Today is Wednesday, May 31st. We're going to talk about blood typing and blood information today. So let's start with that first question up there on the top left. Blood type what carries an A and an Rh antigen?
A positive.
A positive. Is that the only answer that would work here?
No, AB positive.
AB positive, yes. So technically the AB positive blood type also carries an A and an Rh antigen, but not necessarily tricky, right? But yeah, if you had A positive, that would definitely work. I wouldn't put A positive and AB positive as answers on a test, because then you're like, well, which one do I choose, right? So yeah, A positive, that's your best fit.
It would have to be one of those both B and C.
Yeah, none of the both B and C, neither B and C.
Yeah,
that's
wonderful.
Your brain goes.
Yes.
I'm going to go across. So the next question there is going across that row. The universal donor is considered what blood type?
O negative.
Comfortable with that?
Yes.
Okay. Next question is, why is it not entirely accurate when we talk about whole blood donations and O negative being a universal donor? Yeah, good. Antibodies. Woohoo, you got it. So anti-A and anti-B antibodies are guaranteed in whole blood plasma. And you may also have an anti-Rh antibody in there as well. Okay, so you're exactly right. Anti-A, anti-B antibodies are guaranteed in whole blood plasma of O negative. Yeah, anti-A and anti-B antibodies are guaranteed in O negative plasma. And why am I saying you may even have anti-Rh antibodies? It's negative, yeah. And if you're negative, you don't necessarily form those anti-Rh antibodies during your first few years of life. It takes exposure either through pregnancy as an Rh negative mom, or it takes a transfusion of Rh positive blood. So you got to be exposed to the Rh factor to form anti-Rh antibodies. Okay. Do you have any questions, any confusions here I can help clear up? Do you need me to repeat the answer?
Yes.
Okay, so the reason that universal donor is not entirely accurate when we talk about whole blood donation is O negative carries anti-A and anti-B antibodies. O negative carries anti-A and anti-B antibodies. And of course, those antibodies are in the plasma. And you may even carry anti-Rh antibodies. Yep, so you may have anti-A, anti-B, and anti-Rh antibodies. So yeah, if you give whole blood to somebody who has those antigens, what might happen?
Reaction.
A reaction, good. And that reaction, I heard somebody say it, is a glutination. Good, that is a glutination. So we want to avoid that if possible. Yeah, you got the concept. All right, how about this one? We're going across once again. What kind of blood are we looking at here?
AB negative.
AB negative, good. How do you know it's negative?
Because it lacks the Rh.
Good, lacks the Rh factor, good. So this one here going across there is AB negative. All right, doing okay so far? Okay. All right, so we're kind of thinking a little backwards here. We're talking about blood plasma, and it could carry anti-A and anti-B antibodies. Oh, yeah. Why could the answer not be A? Yeah, you wouldn't fight yourself, right?
Right.
So your blood type also would not be B, because you wouldn't fight yourself with anti-B antibodies. And of course, why would this blood type not be AB?
Because antigen
has both. Yeah, you'd be fighting both your antigens. So what we're looking at then is correct. You're looking at O blood, because O carries anti-A and anti-B antibodies. Of course, to an O person, those are foreign antigens. You okay with this one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's see, going across once again, if you're A positive, what blood types? Let's talk about blood cells to avoid confusion. What blood cells would be compatible for you? A positive,
A negative,
yeah, O positive, O negative, good. So blood cells are compatible because we don't have those antibody issues. In terms of getting whole blood, what would be your best compatible blood type if you're A positive?
A positive,
right. Because if you receive O negative whole blood, you're also getting
anti-A, anti-B, anti-RH
antibodies. Yeah, so in the best case scenario, you would get your own blood type if you're receiving a whole blood transfusion. In terms of transfusions, they'll give whole blood for a person who's had a hemorrhage, for instance, just plain old losing blood volume. They will give just blood plasma for a person who's a burn patient. Blood plasma contains a lot of factors that prevent, you know, further blood loss. They have clotting factors in there. They'll give erythrocytes or just platelets or just white blood cells, depending on what a person may need. But yeah, if it's a whole blood transfusion, we would want to avoid transfusing those antibodies that might fight your blood type. All right, so what blood types can O positive receive? Good, O negative and O positive. And I should clarify here, when we're talking compatibility in terms of cells, O negative is certainly okay for an O positive person. Okay, so in terms of cells here, we're looking at O positive and O negative being good compatible choices. How about questions on the second row? You having any difficulties so far? Jenny. Sure, okay. So the blood cells carry the antigens, and the blood plasma is what houses the antibodies. So in terms of cells, we're looking at antigen compatibility. So if I'm A positive and you've got A negative blood cells, then we're just looking at, are the antigens compatible? But if we're looking at whole blood, like with the plasma and everything in there, if I'm A positive and you're A negative, then there's the potential that you may carry anti-RH antibodies in your plasma. So there's a small risk for the A positive person to get those anti-RH antibodies. So blood cell compatibility in terms of donations is a little easier because there's a wider girth of cell types you can transfuse. But when you're talking about blood plasma, now you've got to involve all those antibodies. Okay, does that kind of... Yeah, it is on the recording, yes. Okay. And we can hit this again Monday also after you guys have had a chance to kind of let that thought simmer. Okay. Yep. In fact, these last three questions on the bottom row will also kind of hammer home that point. Okay, so the first question on the very bottom row says, would you recommend giving O positive blood cells to a person with B positive blood?
Yeah.
Yes.
Good, yes. No problems there. Why not?
Because there's no antibodies.
So if you are, let's see, let's get our little visuals out. Okay, if you are B positive and we are transfusing in, or sorry, if you're B positive and we're transfusing in O positive, in terms of compatibility, I'm donating this blood to this person. Am I giving that person anything they've never seen before, something foreign?
No.
No, nothing foreign there. So in terms of blood cell compatibility, we're good to go. The only issue there, of course, is if you happen to give whole blood, what is carried in the whole blood plasma of the O-positive person?
Anti-A and
anti-B. Yeah, so you'd be, if you're giving whole blood, there is a small risk because you're now giving anti-A and anti-B antibodies. It is the anti-B antibodies that could be a problem because they may fight and clump that recipient's blood. I do want to mention it's not an ongoing long-term issue because, you know, your liver and spleen remove and destroy old worn-out blood cells. So if it's a one-off transfusion, maybe for surgery, your body will get rid of that foreign blood in a period of time. And, you know, you can get the blood again. It's just, we're looking at a ratio here of about 5 liters in your body and you know, maybe a pint of blood coming from the donor, or maybe 2 pints coming from the donor. So ratio-wise, we're okay there in terms of our blood volume versus the donor blood volume. Does that make sense? I hope I didn't make a muddy mess of what you had figured out in your head. Okay. Let's do another one. It's the same concept. Okay. Would you give a whole blood transfusion of AB to a person with B blood?
No.
Okay. Let's take the cells first. If we're giving AB blood, we're giving 3 antigens, A, B, and Rh, to a person with B positive blood, what foreign antigen are we introducing?
A.
A. So right there, what's going to happen when we introduce that foreign antigen?
Agglutination,
right. This person is going to have what type of antibodies? The B positive person has
anti-A.
That person's anti-A antibodies recognize the foreign A antigen. They clump and they agglutinate. And so now you've got a big clumped up mess that travels through capillaries and rips holes. Okay. So, you know, it's not even the whole blood that's the problem. It's the blood cells here that are incompatible. Okay. Does AB positive carry any antibodies in their blood plasma?
No.
No. So antibody-wise, we're good, but antigen-wise, we're not, because we're introducing that A antigen to this person with B positive blood. Okay. Any questions on this one? All right, so tell me how you answered the last question. Can you give B positive to AB positive?
No.
Well, yeah, you can.
It's whole blood.
Okay.
This is so
it is confusing. B positive blood has an anti-A antibody. Okay. So if I give all of this to the AB positive person, I am now giving this person an anti-A antibody that clumps and agglutinates. Which antigen?
A.
A, yeah. So in an emergency, you do it, right?
Yeah.
In an ideal situation, why would you not do it?
Because
clumping. Yes, that agglutination, that clumping. Okay. I would say either one. Yeah. It depends on how, if you address it correctly, I'll take it. However you address it correctly. Do you want to repeat this one?
Yes.
Okay. Elizabeth asked a really good question. She says, how do you want to answer? I'll take it either way as long as you answer it correctly. If you've got an argument, if you say an emergency, it's okay. You know, because in an emergency, they're not going to type you. They're just going to grab a bag of blood and go for it.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they're
going to
be dramatic.
Right, yeah. Right. They're not going to let you die from the blood transfusion, right? That's not their goal. But ideally, you would not want to do this because B blood, B positive blood, carries an anti-A antibody, right? And when you give that whole blood to this AB positive person, the blood cells are fine. No problem with the blood cells. It is that anti-A antibody that you're introducing. And so that can cause some small agglutination issues when you give that anti-A antibody to the AB positive person. Okay, and as long as you can explain it correctly, if you know, if you tell me it's an emergency, those antigens are compatible, check, you're good. If you tell me ideally this is not a compatible transfusion because there's anti-A antibodies in the B-positive blood that will agglutinate the AB blood, then I'll take that too. It just depends on your approach. Would you like another one? Okay. No. You're done. That could be. And what I'll do is I'll often say is, I've got a person with this and a donor with that. Do you recommend the transfusion or are there any problems? I'll say to you it's like a first transfusion. I'll tell you if it's like whole blood or just cells. And you don't have to pick that one, but you know, if you do pick it, then you've got a couple of ways to explain it. Yeah. Okay, let me let you stop and think through this one. Okay, so the question specifies cells. I have an O positive cell here. The only antigen I carry is what?
Rh.
The only antigen I carry is Rh. I'm giving this cell to an AB positive person. In terms of antigens, is this okay?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So antigen-wise, O positive is compatible with AB positive if I'm giving O positive to AB positive. Good? Mm-hmm. Make sense?
Mm-hmm. Starts getting all confusing when you introduce the whole blood.
The whole blood. Mm-hmm. So since we're kind of in this conversation, if I'm giving O positive whole blood, I'm giving anti-A and anti-B antibodies along with those cells to this person with AB positive blood, okay? That is the issue, because now I'm introducing anti-A and anti-B antibodies that will agglutinate or clump the antigens on this particular blood cell, okay? So that's why they say O positive, or sorry, actually O negative is not really a universal donor if you're talking whole blood type, because you've got those antibodies to worry about. Okay.
So O, if it doesn't say whole blood, doesn't have any antibodies?
Yes, if it just says blood cells, then don't worry about the antibodies. Do you need another one? Are you ready to move on? Another one. Okay. One more.
Got it.
And antibodies don't even matter for
you.
Agglutination. So why is AB just not a good choice for the A person?
Just B.
This person with the A blood carries an
anti-B.
You got it. Anti-B antibody, and it will fight and agglutinate that B antigen. Yeah. So antigen-wise, this is just a no-go, right? Okay, so antibodies are not even really a part of the conversation. Antigens are a deal killer. So that just killed this deal here, giving AB positive to the A positive person. Okay. What's that?
Vice versa.
Vice versa, giving A positive to AB positive. Antigen-wise, you're good. Antibody-wise, A positive carries an anti-B. Yeah, so there's a small issue there. Are we kind of getting toward? Okay.
Start
glutenating
our brain.
You're right. It's like molasses.
Okay, so just
For whole blood, you almost have to have.
I wouldn't do this. If you need another set of these, we can do them on Monday, just one more time through. You good? Okay. All right, so it looks like we're ready to get back into the new material. That's page 22. At the top of the page, we're just going to go through some basic blood information. You know, this is the only chapter we spend on a particular tissue type. Most organ systems are what we're covering in here, so it's kind of an oddity that we do spend an entire chapter talking about a particular tissue. You know, blood is interesting. It is the only liquid connective tissue. The liquid portion is the blood plasma that makes up around half of your blood. So you'll notice there at the very top there's some fast facts that we're going to run through first. The liquid plasma portion of your blood is what we call the matrix, and that is made by the cells of your body, and that makes up on average around 55% of your blood's volume. You'll notice that the formed elements are the blood cells. They make up around 45% of your blood volume. And, you know, I don't normally advocate memorizing numbers just for the heck of memorizing numbers, but I think it's important to appreciate that we have a little more than half of our blood made up of a liquid part called plasma, and a little less than half made up of blood cells. If you change the ratio here, where you've got more cells and less liquid, you've got thicker blood, like molasses or pancake syrup. You know, if you switch it the other way, where you've got a lot more fluid and a lot less cells, now you've got a really runny blood, you know, something that's like water that goes zooming through your vessels. So it is something to appreciate that we have a little more than half plasma, a little less than half blood cells. When we talk about blood pressure, your blood pressure depends on your blood volume. That is the number one determinant of blood pressure. So I'm going to go back and talk about 5 liters of blood throughout this entire course because that relates to blood pressure and, of course, urine formation. So speaking of blood volume, males have around 5 to 6 liters on average, 5 to 6 liters. Females have around 4 to 5 liters. Just to make it simple, let's say that the average human body has 5 liters of blood. That's going to be our number. The average human body has around 5 liters of blood. You know, here in the United States, we don't work with liters. You know, we work with gallons. And when you talk about I'm drinking a liter of fluid, you know, we don't necessarily have a visual of how much fluid that is. But we do have 2-liter bottles. That is something we're usually familiar with. A large male would have all 3 2-liter bottles full of blood. And a small female would only have 2 of those full of blood. So when you talk about losing blood volume, say due to a hemorrhage, it really drives home a point about how much blood is going to cause severe problems in terms of your overall blood volume. In fact, you'll notice here blood shock, called hypovolemic shock, can occur if you lose only 10 or 20% of your blood volume. That's not a whole lot of blood. So you know, if you're a small female and you've got 4 liters that you're toting around, losing 10 to 20% may not be, but just, you know, down to the label on that bottle, and then you've got a shock issue. So the term hypovolemia, what does that mean?
Low blood.
Yeah, low blood volume, right. So what happens in shock? What kind of symptoms come about then? Feeling faint. Blood pressure's low. Maybe clammy to the touch, cold, clammy to the touch. Okay. So there's numerous types of shock. This particular one can come from bleeding. And, you know, we're very visual creatures. We expect to see blood when someone's bleeding, but in fact, you could be bleeding internally and never even know that person is bleeding. So, yeah, it could be internal blood loss that leads to that hypovolemic shock. Okay, so 5 is our magic number, right? 5 is our average human body blood volume. Let's see, another number to know is this one. pH is around 7.35 to 7.45. Is that acidic or basic?
Basic,
good. Blood is also warmer than body temperature at about 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit. Why is that an important thing to appreciate, that blood is warmer than body temperature? What if it was colder than body temperature? It'd be cold, exactly. So there are some types of surgery, you know, heart surgery, for instance, where they may lower your body temperature to the 80s, and one way of doing that is to chill your blood down, and that chills your body down. So it's kind of like the circulating warmth that helps to maintain a body temp around 98.6. So we also know that blood is thicker than water. The term that means thicker is viscous. Okay, and we just talked about the ratio. Do we have more blood plasma or more blood cells?
Plasma.
More plasma. How could you make your blood thicker by changing that ratio? Give you more cells or more fluid?
Cells.
More cells, yeah. So if you want to make your blood even thicker, just dehydrate yourself, and now you've got the ratio flip-flop, where you've got more blood cells and less blood volume, less blood, plasma and water there. So dehydration, blood cell disorders are a couple of really easy ways to alter your ratio and change the viscosity. Like I mentioned, that's going to play a role in blood pressure. I did want to mention that blood is bright scarlet red when it's oxygenated. We call that oxyhemoglobin. And we know that blood is dark red when it's deoxygenated. There's actually never a time that blood is blue, even though you may see blue vessels in your skin. That is a trick of the eye. It's a combination of the melanin in your skin and the way that your eye perceives color. So dark red in combination with melanin looks somewhat greenish blue through your skin. That's crazy. You know, I don't know how your brain sees blue from that, but you know, you can cut somebody open and look all day and there's never any blue blood in there. So only smirks, right? Okay, so those models that we use in lab are simply color-coded that way with red vessels for arteries and blue for veins, just to give us an easy way to differentiate. But otherwise, you know, you look at a cadaver, you look at a living person, there are no blue veins. So cool stuff. Do y'all have any questions so far on the blood characteristics or functions? So far, so good. Okay. Let's talk about what blood may transport. Oxygen, good. What else? Waste. Hormones, yeah. Carbon dioxide, good. So blood is a river, so to speak, that flows through your body. If you need to transport something from point A to point B, this is the way to go. Nutrients travel this way from your digestive system to your body cells. Waste products travel to your urinary system to be discarded. So there's a lot of good and bad that travels in your bloodstream around your body. Let's see, in terms of regulation, our blood is important for helping us to maintain a regular body temperature around 98.6. You notice that we also regulate blood pH at around 7.35 to 7.45. You know, that's a loaded statement that we'll talk about in urinary and respiratory systems. Your urinary and respiratory system function to make you stay inside that very narrow range for blood pH. Let's think back for water. What are two hormones that help you to retain more water if you're dehydrated? Yeah, aldosterone, good. Which of those two also encourages the retention of salt? Aldosterone, good. Which one is going to encourage water retention when you're too salty? ADH, good. So those two hormones actually help regulate your blood volume. And we know, I'm going to repeat this, blood volume plays a role in blood pressure. So that's going to be an important thing for the next chapter. Okay. And then finally, protection of fluid loss. We have clotting agents that travel in our blood plasma. And we have, of course, leukocytes that fight off foreign infection. So here we are, full circle once again. Down at the bottom of your page, we're going to talk first about the non-living blood plasma, which constitutes around 55% of your blood volume. Just a little more than half of your blood volume is a liquid plasma, okay? And about 45% comes from your blood cells. Do you know which type of blood cell is the most common? Red, white, or platelets?
Red.
Yeah. And you know how an easy way to remember that is, right? What color's your blood? Red, right. So red blood cells actually make up around 45% of your blood volume. That tells me that white blood cells are minuscule in comparison. There's about 1% of your blood coming from those white blood cells and platelets. So this is centrifuged blood. I think it's cool to look at centrifuged blood because, you know, we've got this idea that blood is red and it's going to be red no matter what. But if you put it in a centrifuge and spin it, the heavy stuff sinks to the bottom, and that includes the blood cells. So all this red at the bottom is your blood cells. You can see a slightly different color through there called a buffy coat or a buffy layer, and that coat contains white blood cells and platelets. And then floating to the top, which this looks like about the right ratio, a little more than half, is blood plasma, which takes on a straw color. So there's blood plasma. It looks like urine, doesn't it? So kind of a nasty straw color. Anybody ever donated plasma? Kelly, you've done... They can, but when they do plasma, they'll spin it off and give you back your blood cells. Yeah.
I've been at a plasma donation center for a while.
Oh, yeah. That must be an interesting job.
Yeah, a long time ago, 20-something years ago.
Oh, yeah. For those who've donated, do you want to tell us about the process? Just long, yeah. I've heard you get very cold, yeah. I've also heard that sometimes if they don't set it up right, it makes it feel like you've got knots in that arm coming back in, but I guess it's whoever hooked it up. Yeah. Any idea why you might, or why a company might want just your plasma and not anything else? Could be the nutrients. What else is in there? Could be the hormones. And it's likely some of this stuff. So there's a lot of proteins that float in your blood plasma, and they may in fact want those. So for people who have had a severe burn, they want just the blood plasma to help rebuild their blood volume and also to build back up some of these lost proteins. We're going to learn very soon about blood pressure, and blood pressure is regulated in part by blood proteins. So that first one there called albumin or albumin, you can pronounce it either way, really important, yeah, for maintaining blood pressure. So that particular component is something that people who have lost blood pressure and blood volume are going to need back. Keep in mind that first one, albumin, is made in the liver. So people who have liver disorders may have blood pressure issues. Why is that? Yeah, may not have enough albumin, right, so good one to have. The other two there, globulins and clotting proteins, are also important in maintaining pressure, but they actually have other very important functions. Antibodies are globe-shaped or round-shaped when they float in the bloodstream, and thyroglobulin escorts T4 out to your cells to become T3. Briefly mentioned that back when we covered hormones. And then finally, clotting proteins are things like fibrinogen. Fibrinogen is it's kind of a dissolved protein, and then when it gets to a site where a blood vessel's been cut, chemical reactions turn it into a mesh network called fibrin. We're going to talk about that one today as well. But nonetheless, this is a major part of the blood plasma that's you know, those proteins that we're transporting in the fluid portion. All right, just checking to make sure you got your blank down there near the bottom of your page. Okay. Let's talk about red blood cells over on the top of page 23. Red blood cells are the most common blood cell type. I'm not talking ABO here, right? I'm talking just blood cells in general. And they, of course, are the ones that carry those antigens on their cell surfaces. This is a good test question. From most common to least common, you've got red, then platelets, and then white blood cells. So this is a great picture because it reinforces what we expect. We expect to see the most common cell type here to be a red blood cell. So how would you spot the red blood cells? Concave center, good. What are they missing? Nucleus, right. You know, a nucleus normally stains purple because of the DNA, but since there's no nucleus and no DNA in a red blood cell, they just look like these kind of hollow pink donuts. Yum. So they look like little concave pink donuts. No nucleus there. Let's see. White blood cells are the least common. There's only two in this picture. And can you find the platelets? Yeah, little purple dots, aren't they? So if we were to count, we would probably come up with the correct ratio. Red blood cells are the most common, and second is platelets, and third is white blood cells. Yeah, so this picture follows suit. I did mention that there's no plasma in that picture. It has evaporated, so we actually don't get a sense of the fluid portion of the blood from this blood smear. Okay, so erythrocytes is the fancy name. Red blood cell, or RBC, is the other name we give to these cells. Their function is simply to be like little drones. All they do is circulate in your bloodstream day in and day out, transporting blood gases. Oxygen is the most important one that they transport. Carbon dioxide can find other ways to be transported. But nonetheless, carbon dioxide can also be transported by red blood cells. I did want to make a note here that red blood cells make their own ATP anaerobically. That means they do so without the use of glucose. Without the use of oxygen. So they use glucose directly to make their ATP. So what does the word anaerobic tell you?
No oxygen.
Why is it important that a red blood cell not use oxygen to make ATP from glucose? You're transporting it, right? Imagine if you were tasked with driving the bread truck every morning, and by the time you reached your first delivery, you'd munched away half the bread in the back. And by the time lunchtime came, your bread truck was empty. You know, they wouldn't be very happy if you got to your destinations with an empty truck. Same concept here. You've got to let that oxygen travel. Don't use it up to make ATP. It's going to be made anaerobically without the use of that oxygen. Okay. So you're right, red blood cells are biconcave. That means they're kind of like a tire. So they've got a fat inside, an indented center. They kind of remind me of a, here we go again with food, a donut or an inner tube, but there's no hollow center there. You can't just put your body through the center, but it is concave there in the middle. I kind of think of it like two Frisbees. You know, you've got a Frisbee sitting here and one here. Most Frisbees are pretty flexible, and that's important because these red blood cells have to be able to squeeze through a capillary. Some capillaries are just big enough for the red blood cell to travel through, and other capillaries are too tiny, so they take themselves, they fold in, they float through the capillary, and then they pop back out to their normal size once they emerge. So kind of a cool concept that they're meant to be flexible. These things lack a nucleus. That's a pretty heavy thought. you know, when you learn in Bio 210 about a nucleus, you learn about it being what kind of a function? What does it do? Control center, right? Okay. This is where you've got your DNA. This is where the brain of the cell is housed. What does it mean to you to have a cell without a nucleus? They're brainless. Yeah, they're drones. They're zombies. They float through your bloodstream without any kind of thought or any kind of control, and all they do is circulate for about 3 to 4 months through your bloodstream. And then once they're worn out, that's the end of them. So that's a significant thing. Because there's no nucleus, there's no way to repair these things. You know, there's no way to make proteins or anything else. That's it. They're just little drones that carry oxygen and CO2. In fact, they lack most organelles as well. So these are made in mass. They are not meant to be repaired and replaced, not from a repair standpoint, but, you know, we just generate them all the time, every day, all day, and we just get rid of the old ones and discard them. So red blood cells are so important to transporting oxygen to make that ATP that we have a measurement for them. I know you guys have had this stuff in the lab. In fact, you've had your lab test, right? Mm-hmm. So check, this is dumped, right? Mm-hmm. Hopefully it's still in there somewhere. So what is the hematocrit? What is that a measure of? Yeah, red blood cells in whole blood volume, right? So if I say that we've got 45% of our whole blood volume made up of red blood cells, then that means that the other 55% is approximately what?
Plasma,
yeah. So those white blood cells and platelets contribute so very little to the overall percentage of blood volume. You'll notice that on average, males have a little higher hematocrit, females a little lower. Why the difference here?
But they have more blood.
They have more blood, they have more mass, good. And even testosterone plays a role. Testosterone will beef up your blood volume. So yeah, more body mass, testosterone can increase the hematocrit in a male. No wonder guys have more energy sometimes when you think about it than females. We operate at a lower level all the time anyway. So you add on top of that menstruation once a month, and no wonder you're hovering around that anemia line, right? All right, so in this picture here, you'll notice the erythrocytes are 45% of the whole blood volume. And if it's 45%, then so is the hematocrit. It too is 45% of your whole blood volume. There again is that Buffy coat. It's usually 1% or less of your entire blood. And there's the plasma, which makes up around 55% of our blood volume. So if we said the hematocrit was 40%, you would estimate your plasma to be what percent? 60%. Good. If I said I had 60% hematocrit, you would say the blood volume, the plasma is 40%. Yeah, so around 1% or so for that platelet and leukocyte layer, but that's a very small contribution overall. Okay, so let's see. Let's talk about hemoglobin for just a moment. Way back when you guys studied proteins and Bio 210, they probably talked to you about different levels of protein structure. They talked about primary, secondary, tertiary, and quaternary. Okay, so when you're thinking about hemoglobin, the number 4 is going to be our special number. This is a quaternary level protein. That means it is the most sophisticated twisting of amino acids. There are 4 polypeptide chains here. They've color-coded them. The 2 on top are called the beta globin chains. The 2 on the bottom are your alpha globin chains. Okay, so a total of 4 polypeptides here. They're called globin chains. Each polypeptide chain has its own heme group. Ah, so if you count, there's how many total hemes?
4.
Good. And each heme group carries its own iron. If you count with me again, the magic number is 4. Okay. And each iron can transport an oxygen molecule. And once again, the magic number is 4. Okay, and there's your blank. So each hemoglobin molecule can bind with 4 molecules of oxygen. Just to appreciate what we're talking about here, in a red blood cell, in one red blood cell, you may have 250 million hemoglobin molecules. If each hemoglobin molecule can transport 4 oxygens, you know, good gosh, that's like a billion oxygen molecules transported by one red blood cell. And when you magnify that out by how much blood we're circulating, it's a mind-numbing number of red blood cells and oxygen that we're transporting just in every moment of our lives. That's a tremendous amount of oxygen. Okay, so hemoglobin is good for transporting oxygen, and we've talked about this already. Is your hemoglobin bright red when it's oxygenated or deoxygenated?
Oxygenated,
good. And so OxyHB is an abbreviation for oxyhemoglobin. Hemoglobin is dark red when it's deoxygenated. Therefore, we call it deoxyhemoglobin. I did want to mention that carbon dioxide can also be transported by your hemoglobins, but good news is there's no competition. It binds to a different region of your hemoglobin molecule. So let me put it to you this way. You ever been on a ride in a cab? Let's say your cab has 4 seats. Okay, so if you are taking carbon dioxide along for the ride, carbon dioxide does not battle you for one of those 4 seats. Carbon dioxide says, put me in the trunk, I'm okay there. So you're riding around with 4 seats occupied by oxygen and a trunk full of CO2. Mm-hmm. So there's no competition there for CO2 to also hitch a ride. Okay. Do you have any questions so far about the hematocrit or hemoglobin structure? I think we hit that page. I think we're good to go then. Let's go ahead over to page 24. This looks like a good place for a break, doesn't it? Okay, so what about like, say, 205, 207, somewhere in that area? And then we'll start back with page 24. Okay, let me get you back to the top of page 24. So to kind of wrap up the thought about hemoglobin and oxygen, I wanted to show you this little animation. It's kind of cool because every time oxygen binds hemoglobin, the whole molecule changes shape. And the reason for this is to encourage more oxygens to bind with hemoglobin. Ideally, the max number of 4 is what is, well, it's really what we want to have, you know, transported by a hemoglobin molecule. So if you're anything less than 4, then that hemoglobin changes shape. It's kind of like having an open door that says, hey, I've got a seat for you, come for a ride. So you can see the shift in shape every time you go from deoxyhemoglobin to oxyhemoglobin. So kind of cool. Let's see, on the top of page 24, let's talk about the lifespan of a red blood cell and, you know, all that good stuff. In a single drop of blood, about a cubic millimeter, it's a very small drop of blood, we have between 4 and 6 million red blood cells. You know, in terms of scale, scale that up to 5 total liters of blood, and you're talking about trillions upon trillions of red blood cells in circulation. So in a single drop of blood, we're looking at 4 to 6 million red blood cells. The typical lifespan is around 120 days. Why such a short lifespan? They can't reproduce, they can't regrow, they can't repair. And unfortunately, when they're worn out, they're done. So no nucleus to help them with their repair process. So they're constantly being recycled. Evidence for this comes in your urine. Okay, and the color of your urine is actually from the breakdown of the heme group. So, you know, if you've got a concentrated dark yellow urine, that means there's a lot of broken down heme in that urine. the lighter the color of the urine, then of course the less heme has been placed into there. But that tells you that every single day you're breaking down millions of those red blood cells and putting them out into your urine. It's kind of a strange concept to think about the yellow color being related back to the heme groups here. So speaking of recycling, the primary organ for recycling is your spleen. And if your spleen doesn't exist or is dysfunctional, then your liver picks up the job. The spleen is a porous, sponge-like organ, and when red blood cells travel through, if they have ragged edges, they get trapped in the sponge-like porousness of the spleen and they're removed from circulation. If they're good quality, healthy red blood cells, then they just keep on traveling. They're just going to continue on for another cycle through the body. When we do break down red blood cells, the iron is actually saved to make new red blood cells. The heme is broken down to become bile, or it's removed in our blood, you know, as part of our urine. Bile, you may know, is a yellowish-green color. We'll talk more about that one later on. And those hemoglobin chains, the globin chains to be specific, are actually reused to make new proteins. They may, in fact, become more red blood cells. So since we're looking at such a constant turnover of red blood cells, getting rid of the old and having to bring in the new, let's talk about how long it takes to make a new red blood cell. And that is next. It's called hematopoiesis. And this process includes how we make all blood cell types. So we're going to focus in on a specific type of hematopoiesis that deals only with making red blood cells. That process is going to be called erythropoiesis, but I just want to give you the background here to start with. Hematopoiesis is how we make all of our blood cells, red, white, and platelets. This process occurs in the red bone marrow. Do you know where you have a lot of red bone marrow? Long bones, yeah. You also have it in your hip bones, you know, your coxal bones. Even your sternum and vertebrae have some red bone marrow, so you know your right long bones also have a good deal of red bone marrow as well. There is a stem cell called a hemocytoblast that gives rise to all of our blood cell types. If you break the word down, what is hemo as a prefix?
Blood.
Good. And cyto?
Cell.
And blast. Yeah. Make or generate new cell formation. So if you break it down, it is a blood cell that's making a new generation. So it's generating new red blood cells or white or platelets. So this is a family tree of the blood cells. You don't have to memorize this. I thought I'd just show it to you so you could appreciate the massive family tree. The hemocytoblast is the stem cell that gives rise to all of our cell types, red, white, and platelets. We're not going to pay attention so much to the white blood cell line. You do notice that we give rise to granulocytes and agranulocytes. We'll talk about them in just a minute. And here's the lineage for the platelets. We're going to focus right now, though, on the way we make a red blood cell or erythrocyte. So to start the process of making blood cells, once again, here's a hormone. I joked during 211 that if I told you guys that hormones would never end, you'd probably run the first week of class, but here we go again. So the hormone that stimulates blood cell formation is called erythropoietin. We can call it EPO for short. So what are your kidneys doing? What is their major function in life? Filtering, yeah. Take the bad stuff out of your blood, put it into urine, and get rid of it. Since they're constantly filtering, they're a likely location to pick up on the fact that you may have low blood oxygen levels. So if your kidneys detect low oxygen, your kidneys are the ones to make a hormone called EPO. EPO, like every other hormone, travels the bloodstream. The target is the bone marrow. and it tells those hemocytoblasts to increase red blood cell production. So I'll give you guys a minute if you want to snap a picture or jot this one down. I would know this one. I especially know where it's made and what the target is. Oh, yeah, good to know them. Just checking to see if anybody still needs this one. Okay. So on Tuesday of last week, I flew out to Salt Lake City for that conference that I went to. And the elevation out there was 4,477 feet. And I was really concerned about that because we live at sea level here. I am hypothyroid, I'm anemic, and let's see, what else? I'm on a beta blocker. So I've got a triple whammy against feeling good in high altitude. I'm like, I'm going to die out there. So, you know, I'm thinking, I started taking B12 before I went. I'm like, just anything to make me not feel like I'm just dead walking around out there. And it takes, you can see, 3 to 7 days to make new red blood cells. And I was out there, let's see, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I flew back Monday. I didn't feel very good out there, you know, because you're at like 4,000 or 5,000 foot elevation. And of course, there's low oxygen at high elevation. So it takes about a week's time at minimum for you to get a new burst of red blood cells coming into population. And you're going to have to go through this process of maturing that hemocytoblast into this thing down here, which looks hollow and clear, which is an erythrocyte. So what we do when we make new red blood cells is we take the hemocytoblast, it goes through this maturation process, and we kick this cell here out into circulation. You probably can't see the name on this overhead, but it's called a reticulocyte, and it sits in circulation for a couple of days before it's mature enough to transport oxygen. So, you know, since I was out there almost a week, I'm probably now at the point that these reticulocytes are being pushed into circulation, and give it a day or two, and then they're full-blown erythrocytes. The difference is reticulocytes are not fully capable of transporting oxygen, but the erythrocytes are. So are you going to feel better and more energized with reticulocytes circulating? No, not really. But give them a day or two, let them get into circulation, and then there you go. You've got a new population of erythrocytes that are now in circulation. So 3 to 7 days is generally what it takes for this process to kick off some more red blood cells. So that's kind of what we're looking at here. If we want to know your capability of what's up and coming, we measure your reticulocyte population, not your erythrocytes. Why measure the reticulocyte population? They're turning into erythrocytes, right? What's happening to your erythrocytes every single day? They're dying, right. And they're being removed, they're being recycled, they're being out of your system in circulation. So that's not going to give you a true read. If you want a true read for what tomorrow holds, yeah, measure those reticulocytes because they're tomorrow's erythrocyte population. Yeah. So I did want to mention to you that to make red blood cells, we need a few ingredients. On your worksheet, I did insert a blank there. Iron is one major ingredient we need. B12 is another. And folic acid. I'm sure you've heard of that one. They push it for any female who possibly could get pregnant. It's not only important for making blood cells, it's important for the fetus's spinal cord development. So it's a good one to have all around. So I want to mention something called blood doping for just a moment. You may or may not have seen this in the news. Lance Armstrong is a cyclist, and he's toured with the Tour de France for numerous years back in the late 90s, early 2000s, and he won like 7 Tour de France races bicycling all through Europe. So they had controversy, they had him in the news, and he said, no, I did not blood dope. No, I didn't blood dope. And then finally he said, yep, I blood doped. So finally they took away his 7 Tour wins, and it was this huge scandal. But what he was doing, they kept saying, was he was taking EPO injections. So why do you think that gave him a competitive athletic advantage? More oxygen. Yeah, and the more oxygen you can transport, the more energy you got. Yeah, the more ATP you can make. So it's very hard. I read it because I thought, how did they know he was doing this? It's apparently very hard to detect EPO in the bloodstream. But he combined that with sleeping in a hyperbaric chamber, like at a high altitude. So he was forcing his red blood cells to make, or his body to make more red blood cells. Okay, so let's go back to that beginning conversation. How much, what percentage of your blood should be plasma? 55, yeah, and red blood cells should be 45. If you flip-flop that, now you've got blood that has more red blood cells. Hey, he probably felt like Superman, you know. But do you see any risk here? What are we doing to the thickness of your blood?
Increasing it,
right. And the thicker your blood,
the harder your heart.
Yeah, the harder your heart works. And your blood pressure? Yeah, good. And then, of course, we've got a disorder that we're going to talk about. You probably know the name. Polycythemia. Yeah, so he created a situation where he had polycythemia, heart rate increases, blood pressure increases, all just to make himself more competitive athletically. So,
what's that? And he did it like the whole time? Basically?
Supposedly, yeah. Surprisingly,
win one medal and go home, you know?
Yeah, really. Done, check. Don't do it over and over and over and over, yeah. And he had testicular cancer, so you wonder if there was something else tied in there. Okay, on page 25, let's hit the leukocytes. So, you know, when you think about the leukocytes being your army to fight, you know, you might think the bigger the army, the better. Your body actually doesn't really think that way. Your body says, hey, if I can fine-tune each of you to be a very specialized, specific warrior, then I can have a very small army that does everything. And that's kind of how your body approaches the leukocyte population. So leukocytes do fight infections. They make antibodies to fight those foreign antigens. And they are very specific as to what they fight and how they do it. We don't cover immunology in this class. If you take micro, you'll talk a little more in detail about how the immune system works, but we just touch on it here with an intro to the leukocyte populations. Anatomy-wise, we know that all of our leukocytes have a nucleus of some shape, and all of them have some type of organelles, but they all don't have these granules. There's a category that has granules, and there's a category that does not. Okay, so we're going to classify them by their presence or absence of granules. I did want to mention that these leukocytes travel by diapedesis. Literally translated, it means to walk across or to walk through. So tell me about red blood cells. What is their function? Good. CO2 and oxygen, yeah. And you do this in the bloodstream, day in and day out. But are all infections in your bloodstream?
No.
So you've got to get to the infection. Therefore, you travel across the walls of your vessels, out into your cells and tissues, and there you can attack and kill whatever may be causing an infection. So that's why diapedesis is an important portion of being a white blood cell. All right, any questions so far? 6 to 9,000 is our normal count. So 4 to 6 million red blood cells and only 6 to 9,000 white. And some of them live only a few hours to a few days. You know, if your job is to eat the enemy, you know, you're over and done. But if you are a memory cell that remembers what visited you when you were 5 years old, you're going to live for many, many years. So there's a whole spectrum here of how long these white blood cells may in fact live. I'm just checking to see if anybody else needs this slide. So pretty easy delineation here. We know that granules are found in the granulocytes, and agranulocytes lack the granules. I thought I would take you first through the granulocytes. They typically are bigger than red blood cells. They don't live very long because their job is often to just eat up whatever's causing problems in your body. And we'll look at their lobe-shaped nuclei because that's a telltale sign of what specific type of granulocyte that you've got. What does it mean that granulocytes are phagocytes?
They eat.
They eat, yeah. These are the eaters. Okay, so granules are common in the granulocyte category. They may contain some kind of chemical. Let me start you off with the neutrophils because they're the most common of our white blood cell. In fact, you'll notice on the bottom of the chart, never let monkeys eat bananas gives you the correct order from most common to least common in the white blood cell category. Okay, so never, of course, neutrophils are around 60 to 70% of the white blood cell population. They're just generic garbage guts. They eat bacteria, viruses. So that's just their job. They're just generic eaters. They're phagocytes. Any of you ever had an infection, maybe a sinus infection that you couldn't kick? You know, you go back to the doctor's office. Got one now? Yeah, this is not the time for them, is it? You go back to the doctor's office. You say, I took antibiotics for a couple of weeks. I don't feel good yet. And at that time, they may say, let's take a blood test and see what's going on. And if they come back with a higher population than normal of neutrophils, what's going on? There must be bacteria. Yeah, there must be an infection somewhere. So neutrophil populations will increase when you have some sort of infection. It may not tell us what specific type of infection, but we know that neutrophils eat bacteria for a living, and if their levels increase, we kind of have an idea now what's going on. So compared to the lymphocyte here, you'll notice the neutrophil has 3-lobed nuclei. That's the typical thing to look for. What color do those granules often stain? Pink? Light blue? Anything else? Just a light neutral color? Okay, so did you use the color in lab or did you use the nucleus shape more? Nucleus shape, yeah. So that nucleus shape is a pretty definitive answer. These granule color you can see can change from a pinkish purple here to a lighter color there. That kind of fools with you, doesn't it? So yeah, those 3-lobe nuclei are probably the dead giveaway that you've got yourself a neutrophil. Okay. And there's another one. By comparison, the eosinophils typically have a bunch of granules that stain what color? Red, yeah. In fact, there's so many of them that they block out the view of the nucleus. And those granules may stain a pink to a purple color, orange, but red is a good one to look for because eosin is a stain, and that stain is picked up by those particular granules. What do eosinophils do for a living? Fight allergies and worms, right. So if you go to the doctor's office and you say, I took antibiotics for a couple of weeks, I don't feel any better, and they run a blood test and they say your eosinophils are high, you don't have a bacterial infection. What do you have? Parasites or allergies, right. And if you've got allergies, just go home. Okay, so there's not a whole lot they can do to stop that except for give you some of those certain drugs that block the effects or lower your immune response. So eosinophils are different from neutrophils. They're not really eating bacteria. They're fighting infections like algae or parasitic worms. So interesting set of cells there. Not too many people nowadays have numerous worm infections. You know, they're occasional. But say 100 years ago, you probably couldn't throw a stone without hitting somebody with a worm infection, right? So they think that worm populations have decreased and allergies have increased. So what does that tell you about those eosinophils? They want to kill. They want something to fight, right? So if they don't have worms to fight and kill, they're going to find something else to fight and kill, like the peanuts you just ate, or the eggs, or the mold that's breathed in, or something of that sort. So that's kind of what they think may be happening, is those eosinophils want to fight and kill, but you've got a clean lifestyle, and there's nothing really there to attack and get rid of. Pretty red granules there. How many lobes for your typical eosinophil?
Two
lobes in the nucleus, yeah, so that's a good one to look at. Let's see, the basophils are the least common of all white blood cells, and I keep the B for blue because their granules are often blue or purple. And again, the granules are so numerous, they block out the view of the nucleus here, but if you could see it, it would be two or three lobes. So what is a major job of a basophil? Histamine, good. What does histamine do to you? Vasodilates, right. Do you know what vasodilation is? Vessels relax open, and if you relax your vessels, guess what happens to your blood pressure? It drops, right. We have histamine reactions locally around mosquito bites. If you have itchy, watery eyes with allergies, that's a histamine reaction. But the worst kind comes when you have a type of shock or hives all over the body. That can cause a big drop in blood pressure. Okay. Let's see, we've got two types of agranulocytes. We've got lymphocytes and monocytes. They're not the lovers like we just saw with the granulocytes. Those granulocytes love a stain color, thus the suffix of phil. These particular cells here don't love stains, they're just big, and you'll notice the nucleus is also going to fill most of the size of the cell. What is the major job of a lymphocyte? Yeah, antibodies, right. Fighting infection, making antibodies. These are very specific because they make antibodies against a specific antigen. Okay, so when we talked about anti-A antibodies and so forth, these lymphocytes are making those antibodies for us. I want to show you monocyte nucleus and compare that back to a lymphocyte nucleus. Which one of these has kind of a kidney bean or a Pac-Man shaped nucleus?
Monocyte,
yeah. Notice the lymphocyte has a fairly round nucleus in comparison, so one way to tell them apart is by that nucleus shape. So monocytes are good for eating, you know, not for us to eat, but they like to eat within your bodies. They can transform into a huge cell called a macrophage. Phage means what? To eat, yeah, big eater. So if you have an infection, like let's say you got a dog bite, you know, these macrophages are going to migrate to that area and eat up the infection. They're not going to live very long because they are going to be recycled and removed once they eat that bacteria and get rid of the infection. Okay, so that covers our white blood cell population. I know you guys have been through your lab tests and had the stuff already, but do you have any questions? Okay. So the smallest in terms of size are your platelets, and that's our last type of cell. They are called thrombocytes, but we know them more as platelets. What's the major job of a platelet?
Clot
blood, good. How long do they live?
10 days.
About 10 days, right. Okay, no nucleus, hardly any organelles, and of course there's no way to repair these things. These little tiny cell fragments are going to be removed and recycled very frequently, about every 10 days, but they're very common in the blood, much more so than your white blood cell population. So So we commonly see about 150,000 to 350,000 in a drop of blood. Okay, disclaimer here. Pick up any textbook, do any web search, and they're going to give you different population numbers and even perhaps different lifetime lengths for these cells. Depending on what lab does the testing, they may say 100 to 400,000. So just know that these numbers are a little flexible. They fall within a ballpark range, but I'm using the ones that the Ammerman textbook uses. That's the book that we use for the course. So nonetheless, they float a little bit depending on what lab. I would know, like, I may say to you, I've got a platelet count of 300,000. Am I normal? Am I too high? Am I too low? So you know the ballpark. I'd like to take you on a short tour of blood cell disorders. They're over on the next page. That's the top of 26. Our first blood cell disorders are red blood cell disorders. So we've got anemia and polycythemia first. Which one of these might be described as a low red blood cell count? Anemia, good. Or we might describe anemia as an inability to transport adequate oxygen. You know, the weird thing is, you may have 4 to 6 million red blood cells in a cubic millimeter, but there may be some problem transporting adequate oxygen. So even though you have a normal blood cell count, you still may have some disability or inability to transport adequate oxygen levels. So anemia has multiple causes. I thought I'd take you through a few. And then we'll talk in just a moment about polycythemia, which runs on the other end of the spectrum. This first one is called iron deficiency anemia. This is very common for females. Why do you think so?
Periods,
yeah. Menstrual cycles, you know, remove a few hundred milliliters of blood every month. And if you're sitting on the borderline for your hematocrit levels, this can just tip you down into that anemia or iron deficiency anemia level. I'm not sure if you can see it from where you're sitting, but a lot of these red blood cells look spiky, and that's because they have not enough iron in there to make their hemoglobins structured properly. So kind of an interesting look at some of these spiky ones. There's one right there. There's a great one right there. Another form of anemia is a genetic condition called sickle cell anemia. We very well understand how this one is passed. You can have parents who appear to be normal but actually carry the sickle cell trait, and there's a 25% chance those parents produce a child with sickle cell anemia, which is the full-blown disease. You can still have symptoms if you simply have one faulty allele, which is saying that you have the trait. It's called SCT if you just carry the trait. And if you happen to have full-blown sickle cell anemia, they call it SCA, because then you've got both faulty alleles. It's only one amino acid that goes wrong when we inherit sickle cell anemia. One amino acid, that's incredible. And notice how it makes that red blood cell completely misshapen. Normal red blood cells should be round and shaped like a biconcave disc. And just like a sickle, there is one of those sickled red blood cells. So what kind of symptoms do you think a person may experience with the full-blown disease? Pain? Low oxygen. Yep. Fatigue, joint pain, fever, okay? And, you know, most people with anemia have low energy because they've got low oxygen being transported. But this one comes with a whole host of other symptoms. And unfortunately, right now, there's no way to get rid of this disease since it's a genetic condition. We don't really have a way to insert that appropriate amino acid back in at this point. We do find that people with an African heritage are more likely to have this particular disorder. There is a reason for this. People in the equator belt of the world are often more exposed to malaria. So if you live where malaria is more common, the little malaria plasmodium has a really hard time getting into that sickled red blood cell. So believe it or not, there's actually a benefit to having sickle cell anemia if you live in the malaria belt. It keeps you from getting malaria. So imagine the trade-off there. That's why this particular red blood cell disorder stays common in populations of people. It's going to keep you from dying from that malaria infection. Let's see, this is a pretty bad form of anemia. It's called pernicious anemia, and it is a vitamin B12 deficiency. So we're going to learn more about this as we go throughout the course, but B12 comes from animal products. Eggs, meats, these are great sources of B12. In order to absorb B12, you've got to have a factor in your stomach called intrinsic factor. So for people who have, say, a stomach bypass, like a gastric bypass surgery, they may not get enough B12 absorbed into their bloodstream. So there's a lot going on here with pernicious anemia. We link it with stomach issues. We also link it with diet issues. Okay, so what is going on with polycythemia? Increase, yeah, so too many red blood cells. Let's talk about that ratio again. Normally, we should have around 55% of your blood volume made of what? Good, and 45% red blood cells, good. This is a case where we're gonna flip-flop those ratios. If you're transporting too many red blood cells, what does that do to your viscosity? Thicker, yeah. So the heart works harder, your blood pressure increases, and it's like moving concrete, sludgy concrete through your vessels. One treatment for this kind of bone marrow cancer is to simply have blood drawn off every 2 weeks. And of course, that can help to reduce the thickness or viscosity of your blood. So this is technically bone marrow cancer, it's one form of it. But people who live at a high altitude may also develop a type of polycythemia just from having low oxygen in their environment. So imagine having this disorder and living at a high altitude. You kind of got a double whammy going on there. So why would high altitude living induce polycythemia? Good. There you go. Good, you got the whole cycle there. So you're right, we got low oxygen, that's the issue. That turns on EPO. Kidneys make the EPO. That targets what?
Bone marrow.
Bone marrow, right? And bone marrow takes about how many days to make new red blood cells?
3 to 7.
About 3 to 7, yes. Yeah, so you've got this cycle that kicks on whenever there's low oxygen levels. Let's see, I'd like to talk you through a few white blood cell disorders. They're halfway down your page. You ever known anyone with leukemia? Do you recall how they felt when it started?
Tired.
Pain. I've also heard people with leukemia feel like they have the flu. But it's not really the flu. And if you look at the symptoms here, a lot of it looks like the flu. You know, fatigue, loss of appetite, weight loss and fever, muscle weakness, painful tender joints and bones. Yeah, this sounds like every day, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know? So that sounds like a typical onset for the flu or the wintertime, you know, cold season. And then you look at these other things like purplish patches and spots, bruising and bleeding, night sweats, enlarged spleen, things of that sort. That doesn't really sound like the flu. That sounds like we're getting into a different issue. So yeah, a lot of symptoms here start sounding like just tired, pain, achiness, and the flu-like symptoms. But what is actually happening here is there are immature white blood cells released into the bloodstream. Well, there's 5 different types of white blood cells. They fight allergens, they fight parasites, and if you're releasing immature, they can't do their job properly. Brooke?
Is there something happening with the red blood cells too?
There is.
Eyes?
Yeah. If you're releasing immature red, you're probably also releasing immature, or sorry, if you're releasing immature white, you're also releasing immature red. Yeah, so people may have anemia, other issues arise that are not necessarily white blood cell related. Let's see. Next one there is called leukopenia. This is actually too few white blood cells. And in the case where someone takes an immunosuppressant drug, the white blood cell populations decrease. All right, so going back, do you remember what a glucocorticoid is? Cortisol, good. What are the two big jobs of cortisol? Long-term regulation of sugar. And the other issue is it suppresses your immune system, yeah. So steroids like prednisone, over-the-counter, you know, not over-the-counter, but what do they call it? Generic Dexpack, things like that. Those kinds of medications are corticosteroids, like glucocorticoids, and they will suppress your immune system, making you more likely to what? Get sick, exactly. So for those who take things like Flonase, Claritin, Zyrtec, those are the same types of medications in that they lower your immune response, and if you stay on them for, say, weeks or months on end, up and pops up this weirdo cold. So, you know, if you take Flonase or Claritin or one of those for weeks, your immune system is lowered, your white blood cell population becomes leukopenia, and then you catch whatever pops along. So
eventually, if you treat the symptoms that eventually will make
us
sick.
Yes. Yeah. So if you take it for a few days, go off of it. Take it for a few days, go off of it.
Yeah. Oh, my
goodness. Yeah.
Oh, very
interesting. Scary stuff. All right, our next one is mono. Mono is called the kissing disease, but that's not the only way you can catch it. Yeah, this one is something that people who live in close quarters like apartments or dorms or even in the same household are more likely to get from each other. And it can be transmitted through drinking glasses or through saliva or sneezes or, you know, bodily fluids like that. And it's caused by a virus called the Epstein-Barr virus. Well, monocytes, you know, they're big and bad. They say, I'm going to eat whatever comes along. Well, when they eat the Epstein-Barr virus, it's a pretty tough one to kick. So these monocytes don't look too good. They look a little unhealthy there. They become infected. It takes months to conquer the virus and get your immune system back in line. And it may result in a long-term deficiency called chronic fatigue syndrome, or CFS. So this particular virus, like all viruses, may hide in your body, and it may take just a stressful event to allow it to come back out and become active again. But most of the time, once your antibodies are built against the virus, as long as it doesn't mutate, you've got immunity for life from that particular virus. So that's an unfortunate thing about infectious mononucleosis. It's called mono because it infects your monocytes. And the last one here, this is leukocytosis. I think you'll notice all of these are white blood cells. How do you know? Purple. Yeah, that means they have a nucleus. Good. So lots and lots of white blood cells. And unfortunately, this means this person probably has what?
Infection.
Infection, yeah. The most common type of white blood cell is neutrophil. Yeah. So odds are these are neutrophils, and odds are there's a bacterial infection. So, okay, so that's the white blood cell disorders and red blood cell tour. Brooke?
On your chest, do you put pictures on
that? Yes.
I don't put black and white. If I put a black and white, and they're all black and white, it would be a cell with a very obvious nucleus or whatever. But I wouldn't put anything like what you just saw. Yeah, being black and white would be very hard to tell. Yeah. So this is actually where we left off. We were talking about platelets, and then we skipped over and talked about disorders. So we're back kind of full circle here to page 28. Just wanted to review those platelets for just a moment. Their major job is to clot blood, and clotting blood is a major issue because that's a way for us to prevent blood loss. So I'd like to take you through the blood clotting process on this page. The term for blood clotting is called hemostasis. I know you've heard a similar word called homeostasis, but the hemo means what? Blood. Yeah, hemo means blood. So there's three steps or phases to blood clotting. You can accomplish these three steps in around 3 to 5 minutes. Okay, so a very short time period, 3 to 5 minutes. I'm going to start you off with the first step called vascular spasms. So you don't necessarily feel this happening. In fact, you wouldn't feel this happening. But if you happen to nick yourself, say with a paper cut or maybe with shaving or something like that, we actually had our blood vessels start to clamp down and squeeze in an attempt to limit blood loss. And so we call this first step of squeezing the blood vessels vascular spasms. So this is going to happen within moments. There's a chemical called serotonin released by the vessel and by blood cells, and that's going to make sure that that blood vessel starts to clamp shut. So this can be from internal bleeding. This can also be from external bleeding. You know, like I said, we're visual. We expect to see blood flowing outside our bodies. But yeah, sure, you can have bleeding occur internally as well. The next step is called the platelet plug formation. And the name's pretty much going to tell you what we're doing. You'll notice that inside the blood vessel, we have a lining of simple squamous epithelial tissue. If you break that lining, the connective tissue down below will have collagen fibers. And those collagen fibers kind of hang like broken wires down into the vessel, and those platelets will now cling onto those collagen fibers. I kind of think of Tarzan here. You know, one swings onto the collagen, they say, hey, look, party time. They call for more. More and more platelets will cling onto that side of a ruptured vessel. This is a positive feedback mechanism. So by it being a positive feedback mechanism, are we trying to enhance the number of platelets arriving or shut it down? Enhance, right. So platelets holler for more platelets through a chemical message in the blood. And so as platelets are swooping past in the blood flow, they stop and they cling on to that ruptured site. The goal is to do what? Stop the bleeding, right. Now, I wanted to mention that if you happen to have a fairly minor cut, we can mimic both of these steps at home. The first step here, vascular spasms, what do we do to mimic that step?
Apply pressure.
Apply pressure. Yeah, push on it. That helps to close off the blood flow through. What do we do to mimic the platelet plug?
Band-aid.
Put a Band-Aid on, yeah. So that can help those platelets cling to that site there. The catch is Band-Aids have a chemical on there that keep the platelets from clinging to the bandage because nobody wants to rip the Band-Aid off and have the platelet plug to come to. If that happens, what occurs in your wound?
Bleeding.
Bleeding again, yeah. So I noticed most of you said apply a bandage. Most of you did not say put Kleenex or toilet paper on there, which does not have a chemical inhibitor. And if you do rip that off 5 or 10 minutes later, there comes the platelet plug and ow, the bleeding restarts, right? Okay, so it's important to use something that uses a chemical inhibitor, gauze, bandages, those all have some kind of chemical inhibitor. So the last step is called coagulation. Coagulation is different from agglutination. Let's go back to agglutination for just a moment. Agglutination occurs when you have anti-A antibodies come into contact with A antigens. Yeah. And that anti-A antibody looks like a Y, and it will stick to and agglutinate that foreign antigen. Okay? That's a totally different concept from what we're getting ready to discuss. Coagulation is the process of blood clotting. It has nothing to do with antibodies or antigens. So there are various factors in your blood that help to get us to the point of clotting our blood. The goal here is to form a clot called a thrombus. And we do that by converting fibrinogen, one of those plasma proteins, to a visible soluble fiber known as fibrin. And when we finish with coagulation, we've transformed the blood around this broken vessel from a liquid state to a gel-like state. Okay, so I don't know about you. I never picked at scabs as a kid, but some people do. You know, they love to pick the scabs off and, oh, have it re-bleed. But if you've ever paid attention to a fairly big scab, you may notice as it's drying up, you know, it looks like it's turning into a solid. That's really the goal of coagulation, and it occurs very quickly. The goal here is to make the blood stop moving, make it stop bleeding, and we do that by turning your blood into a jelly-like consistency. That's what coagulation is. So, not the same thing as agglutination. It's a process of stopping the bleeding. So from vascular spasms to platelet plug to coagulation, 3 to 5 minutes, okay? Let's see, I got a little bit left on this page. Instead of hitting that today, why don't we make a note? We'll pick up and finish that bottom half on Monday. I'm gonna do a little heart anatomy on Monday, and then I'll leave you plenty of time for Q&A for test number one. All right, y'all have a good weekend. Thank you.